28th, Monday. We're dealing with Senate file number one today as amended. This bill is the part of the Affordable Health Care bill. We'll talk today about the marketplace and some other issues in this bill. There's about 22 to 25 testifiers, and my plan is to hear briefly 2 to 3 to 4 minutes from each, and we will allow questions as we go along, and we're going to keep a pretty tough time frame here today. There will be no amendments today. We're going to be hopefully good listeners and then think about things over the next couple of days, and if we can make Senator Lurie's bill a little better, we'll try to do that. So with that, I think we'll start. Senator Lurie, why don't you give us a brief? We heard a lot of this the other day, or some of it anyway, from April, but you may proceed. Senator, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Got Senate File 1 before you today, and I'm very happy to be here before you. Senate File 1 establishes a Minnesota-based health insurance exchange under the Affordable Care Act with the broad goal to establish a consumer-friendly website where Minnesotans can comparison shop for a health insurance policy that best meets their needs and access available federal tax credits and premium and cost-sharing supports. It's important that for those without internet, this bill also ensures alternative methods for accessing the exchange, and like a toll-free number and things like that. What I was kind of thinking about doing here is, you know, one of the questions I constantly come up against is why we're on such a timeline. I thought I'd step us through that and then give a kind of an idea of where we're at in the process, and then go through. I know that the Commerce, this is a big deal to the Commerce Committee. It is largely an insurance bill, so I thought I would just step through technically exactly what's in the bill today and assure members that I fully understand these are significant changes to a large segment of Minnesota's economy that touches people where they live. And I am taking this very seriously. I have been running an open door policy. There are concerns about this bill, and I am trying to take them very seriously, meeting with everybody that I possibly can to understand their concerns fully and get the right bill at the end of the day to really protect Minnesota consumers, individuals, and small businesses, and Minnesota's health insurance and health care industry in the very best way possible. And I think that a Minnesota approach is far preferable to the alternative, which is a federal one-size-fits-all approach. So with that, again, the timeline and why, maybe just step you through that quickly. You know, we have to be done with this bill, which is the major components of the nuts and bolts, inner workings of the exchange itself. We have to be done with it by March, and it's good by the end of March. It's good to understand where that comes from. January 1, 2014, is explicit in the Affordable Care Act itself that these plans will be covering people's lives. They will be effective January 1, 2014. There is also a required 3-month open enrollment period for people to come to the exchange and do their comparison shopping and make their choice of what product will be covering their lives. So that brings us back to October 1st of 2013, this very year. And in the blueprint that we submitted back in February to the feds, I mean back in November rather, we agreed, and it is important to give the industry 6 months to build the products that will populate that exchange. That moves us all the way back to the March date that we're working under right now. And so I hope that really provides some context of why we're on such a tight timeline. And it's hard to be on such a tight timeline, but that's why I'm making myself so available and really trying to work hard, and really appreciate members' support in this incredibly involved undertaking. So with that, also the general approach that we've been taking. I'll just say we introduced a pretty bare bones bill at the beginning of session. We've been putting meat on those bones at every stop. We first stopped at Senator Pappas's State and Local Government Committee, and we added a lot of details around the governance board and compensation around it. We stopped next at the Judiciary Committee. We did a lot of work on data issues and appeals processes and the like, and truthfully, really improved this bill.
Yeah.
And I fully expect that in the Commerce Committee here and on Wednesday, we will offer further improvements that are needed to add some meat on the bones to help people understand where we're going. It's also important to note that this is the third of really nine committee stops in the Senate that are kind of part of the anticipated path right now. After the committee stops, of course, is the floor, and then unless Representative Atkins just accepts the Senate version, I'm anticipating a conference committee and then another floor action on the bill. So that's 12 stops and good conversations with a lot of conversations in between each one where we hopefully can, again, get to the right place. So with those brief introductory remarks, I will just begin to step members through exactly what the bill is, nuts and bolts. So Senate File 1 establishes what's known as the Minnesota Insurance Marketplace. Section 1 of the bill specifies in Chapter 13 that the classification and sharing of data of the marketplace is governed by a new section that's described in the bill later on, and we'll get into it when we get there at 62V06. Section 2 of the bill specifies in the open meeting chapter that the meetings of the marketplace are governed under another new section, 62V03. I'll describe that when we get to it as well. Section 3 states that this chapter is cited as the Minnesota Insurance Marketplace Act. I have been making people aware of the fact that nobody really likes this name, but nobody really likes the name the exchange either, and they're the Exchange Department is working on a stakeholder group trying to come up with a name that works a little bit better. So somewhere in the process here, we anticipate inserting another name. But for this purpose, we'll just call it the Exchange or the Marketplace as we move forward. Section 4, still on beginning on page 1, defines the following terms: the board, health benefit plan, health carrier, individual market, insurance producer, Minnesota insurance marketplace, navigator, public health care program, and small group market. Section 5 of the bill, towards the bottom of page 2, is actually the creation of the marketplace. Subdivision 1 creates the marketplace as a board with the following duties. Paragraph 1, duties, promote innovation, competition, quality, value, market participation, affordability, meaningful choices, health improvement, care management, reduction of disparities, and portability of health benefit plans. Paragraph 2, to facilitate and simplify the comparison, choice, enrollment, and purchase of health benefit plans for both individuals and for employers shopping through the marketplace. Paragraph 3, to assist small employers with access to small business health insurance tax credits and to assist individuals access public health care programs and the premium assistance tax credits and cost-sharing reductions, as well as the certificates of exemption from the individual responsibility requirements where they apply. And paragraph 4 there is to facilitate the integration and transition of individuals between public and the public programs and the individual market. Subdivision 2 outlines the applicability of other laws in terms of the marketplace and how they apply. Paragraph A states that the marketplace is subject to review by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. So that's a good, robust piece of oversight that I know that many in the legislature are very comfortable with. Paragraph B states that board members are subject to the conflict of interest and the gift ban. Paragraph C requires that all meetings of the board comply with the open meeting law, with the exception of meetings regarding personnel negotiations, contract negotiations, and meetings where not public or trade secret information are being discussed. Paragraph D states that, except as provided elsewhere in this act, that's the 62V05, the marketplace is exempt from Chapter 14, which is largely rulemaking, and that the marketplace is exempt from 16A-1283, which is the procedures for adopting rules, and the marketplace is exempt from the legislative approval for fees for the limited purpose of setting the fees identified in this act. Those are the withholds that are there later. The marketplace would need that explicit authority in order to be able to execute that piece of the act. Section 6 of the bill, beginning on page 3, is where we get into the governance structure of the board. Subdivision 1 states that the marketplace will be governed by a board of directors consisting of 7 members. Subdivision 2 describes the board membership and appointments. Generally, there are 3 considered consumer representatives, 3 considered industry representatives, and then the 7th is the commissioner of the Department of Human Services. These are generally subject to the open appointments process, except for the very first appointments, which we just don't have time to go through the full-blown open appointments process. So we have a bit streamlined for that. Subdivision 3 describes the terms of the board membership. Subdivision 4 describes the conflict of interest specifications that board members must meet. Subdivision 5 requires the governor to designate one of the appointees as the acting chair until the first meeting. The first meeting has to be held within 60 days, and at that first meeting, the board will elect their own chair. Subdivision 6 requires the chair to be elected by a majority and states that they'll serve for a year. Subdivision 7 requires the members of the board to elect officers. Section 8 spells out how board vacancies will be filled. Subdivision 9 states that a board member may be removed only for cause and specifies that a conflict of interest shall be cause for removal. Subdivision 10 requires the board to meet at least quarterly. It is certainly anticipated that early on there will be many, many more meetings than quarterly meetings required, but over time that would be the bare minimum would be quarterly meetings. Subdivision 11 describes what constitutes a quorum. It's important in there that even if you have a quorum that is more than half of the members showing up, you do need votes that represent half of the entire board to pass anything. So if 4 members show up and you have a quorum to take action, it would still require all 4 members to vote for anything undertaken at that meeting in order to pass it. Subdivision 12 authorizes compensation for the board members, capped at 25% of the governor's salary. This is something in the ballpark of $30,000. The process for setting the salaries is in accordance with Section 15A. 0815, where the appointing authority submits recommendations to the Legislative Coordinating Commission. Subdivision 13 authorizes the board to establish as necessary advisory committees. It's important to note that there later on in the bill there are mandatory advisory committees for industry concerns and consumer concerns and stakeholders in the process. Section 7 begins on page 5 of the bill and describes the basic responsibilities of the marketplace. Subdivision 1, paragraph A, requires the marketplace to implement and operate the marketplace in accordance with this chapter and makes sure that all applicable state and federal laws also apply. Paragraph B authorizes the marketplace to employ personnel and delegate administrative, operational, and other responsibilities to the director and other personnel, specifies that the director and managerial staff are unclassified and governed by a compensation plan prepared by the board, submitted to MMB for review and comment, and then approved by the Legislative Coordinating Commission and eventually the legislature itself. Paragraph 2 establishes the budget for the marketplace. Paragraph 3 allows the marketplace to seek and accept money, grants, loans, donations, materials, services, or advertising in order to help fund the operations of the marketplace. Paragraph 4 allows the marketplace to contract for the receipt and provision of goods and services. Paragraph 5 allows the marketplace to enter into information sharing agreements with state, federal, and other entities, provided that the agreements include adequate protections and comply with all applicable state and federal laws, regulations, and rules. And paragraph 6 allows the board to take other actions reasonably required to implement and administer its responsibilities. Paragraph C requires the board, within 180 days of an enactment, about 6 months, to establish their bylaws, policies, and procedures governing the operations of the marketplace. This is actually pretty critical. It is a blueprint requirement. This is what we agreed to with the feds. So within 6 months of passing of this bill, the board would have to have their policies and procedures and all of their rules up and operating so that everybody understood where we were headed. Subdivision 2, we're on to page 6 now, if folks are tracking, establishes a funding mechanism for the operations of the marketplace. Paragraph A states that beginning on January 15th of 2015, the board is authorized to retain and collect a withhold of up to 3.5% of premiums for the individual and small group market plans sold through the exchange. Paragraph B is that prior to January 1, 2015, the marketplace shall retain that withhold of 3.5% of premiums for the individual and small group market. That's to establish some operating reserves for them and to get them off to a good start and make sure that they have the money they need to carry it forward. Paragraph C requires that funds collected for the operations of the marketplace cover any compensation provided to navigators in the program. Subdivision 3, then, establishes requirements and compensation for insurance producers. I suppose in leading up to this, I will say I am working diligently with groups that are concerned about this section and fully anticipate that on Wednesday we'll have something different to offer. We're not ready to offer it today, so I will just let it suffice to describe what's in the bill today as we move forward, but with that caveat.
That's going to be, Senator, that's going to talk about the agents and brokers, is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Wednesday, so we're going to probably have some, I believe we will have some language in here for the or to pay our agents and brokers as we go through the process here.
Mr. Chair and members, I've been working diligently with agents and brokers trying to come up with something that that meets their needs. Truthfully, on introduction, I kind of liked this. I thought it should work for them. They disagreed, and that's fine. We've been engaging in fruitful conversations, and I believe we'll get to a place that they're more comfortable with, and that'll work fine, and we'll work within that marketplace. And I've welcomed those conversations, and they will continue.
I know you've been working in this area along with many other areas, but this one I'm very familiar with. Thank you.
This one in particular. So again, with those caveats, what's in the bill today, Monday, January 28th, for compensation for insurance producers, paragraph A authorizes the board to establish requirements and compensation structure for insurance producers, assisting individuals and small employers with coverage through the marketplace. Paragraph B requires that within 30 days of enactment, the commissioner of MMB would establish these requirements and compensation plans for insurance producers. Paragraph C states that beginning January 2015 and going forward, the board is authorized to collect a withhold of premiums to fund this compensation that is set at the NAIC EyeSight level. This is the National Association of Insurance Commissioners estimate for what it costs to provide this function to the marketplace broadly, and so we set up a structure where the marketplace could collect that and figure out how to compensate brokers within that pool of money, and still, while setting the right incentives for the market to reach out to underserved populations, maybe uninsured, try to address health disparities, try to make sure that defined contribution plans worked well within the exchange. But again, this is all up in the air in really active conversations with the broker community. Subdivision 4 establishes the policies and procedures for navigators, in-person assisters, and the call center. So that's moving beyond the brokers themselves. Paragraph A within Subdivision 4 authorizes the board to establish the policies and procedures for ongoing operations of the navigator, in-person assister program, call centers, and customer service provisions beginning January 2015 and moving forward. Paragraph B states that prior to the implementation of the policies and procedures that would begin in 2015, for the first year, basically, the Navigator program would be met by Section 256.962. Members probably know this as the MNCA statutes. This is the entity within DHS that helps those folks trying to get on public program, those public program enrollees, find the right place and the right plan within our public thing. So that's how it would. That's how the Navigator would be functioned in the first year.
Senator?
Yes.
I think I know some examples, but give some examples to the committee members and the viewing audience of what groups can be, like navigators, or for example, like Moose Lodge can be, or the CAP agencies, or people that they're comfortable with it.
Yeah.
So we all know. Who,
And people in our communities today helping folks navigate and find the right place within our public programs. That's the MNCA statute. The trusted sources of information within specific communities would still be able to operate as navigators. They'd come to the exchange and become navigators and be able to be compensated for this. So, I mean, you could have them at hospitals, at nonprofits, at cultural centers that are very difficult populations to reach often, and make sure that we have the broadest participation in the market as you can have. The navigator requirements are that they have some training to make sure that they understand the implications of the tax credits that are being offered to individuals and the liabilities for changing income situations throughout the year. But it's really akin to having our outreach efforts for those underserved populations met by several of the nonprofit partners and counties. Would be eligible as well. Brokers themselves are eligible to participate in the Navigator program. So it's really broad outreach efforts to help foster a better understanding of all of the options available for consumers broadly throughout the entire marketplace. Does that help, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, I think that was very good. Thank you.
Paragraph 2 within this, paragraph B, says that all entities eligible to be navigators may also serve as the in-person assisters. Paragraph 3 says that the MMB shall establish the requirements and compensation for the navigator program and in-person assister program within 30 days of enactment, and that the call center operations shall utilize existing state resources and personnel, including referrals to counties for medical assistance. Paragraph C, still within sub 4, requires the Commissioner of MMB to establish a toll-free number. On page 7 in subdivision 5, towards the bottom, our health carrier requirements and participation. Paragraph A authorizes the board to establish certification requirements for health carriers and plans offered through the marketplace beginning January 1, 2015 and forward. And basically, this gets hard to read, but it's unless essentially the market rules bill that requires the same rules inside and outside the marketplace for both the individual and the small group market that also meets all federal requirements is passed by this legislature by the time we are done this year. So if we adopt And this was a strong recommendation out of the task force, members should know. The task force recommended the same rules inside and outside the market, the exchange, in order to prevent adverse selection. But we didn't choose to take that on in this bill because it's another big conversation. But we will have it before we close that conversation. I'm not presupposing where we will wind up, but if we take the task force's recommendation and create the same rules inside and outside the exchange, thereby really lessening the risk of adverse selection. The current structure would mean that the ability for the marketplace itself to establish certification requirements would go away. So beginning January 1, 2015, the marketplace has the authority to set certification requirements unless we do the same inside and outside bill by the close of this session. Just trying to hope that was clear. Paragraph B authorizes the board to select health carriers and plans for participation in the marketplace. The selection must be in the interest of individual consumers and employers and satisfy all federal requirements. Paragraph C is really the Indian addendum. It states that for all health plans offered through the marketplace beginning in January 2015, health carriers are required to use the most current addendum for Indian health care providers approved by CMS. Moving on to subdivision 6, this sets procedures for appeals of board decisions. Paragraph A requires the board to establish a process for appeal of individual or employer eligibility determinations of the marketplace. Paragraph B authorizes the marketplace to establish service level agreements with state agencies to conduct hearings for appeals. Paragraph C states that the marketplace may be represented by an attorney who is also an employee of the marketplace. Paragraph D makes the appeals process inapplicable to appeals of determinations where a state agency hearing is available for certain human services matters. Essentially, that says that for those DHS appeals that exist today for Medicaid determinations, DHS will still do those Medicaid appeals. Subdivision 7 states that a health carrier aggrieved by a decision of the board regarding compliance with certification requirements is entitled to a contested case proceeding under Chapter 14. That's a bit more formal and in-depth process and necessary because of the great interest of gaining access to these markets on behalf of the carriers and plans. Subdivision 8, paragraph A, requires the board to establish and maintain agreements with, paragraph 1, an agreement with Minute in the Office of Enterprise Technology for Information Technology Services to ensure coordination with public health care programs and other information technology services. The second requirement for agreements is with the DHS for cost allocation and services regarding eligibility determination and enrollment for public health care programs. The third requirement is for the Commissioners of Commerce and Health for services regarding enforcement of the marketplace certification requirements for plans offered through the marketplace and permissive on other service contracts as well with Commerce and Health. Paragraph B requires the board to consult with the Commissioner of Commerce and Health regarding operations of the marketplace. Paragraph C requires the board to consult with Indian tribes regarding the operations of the marketplace. Paragraph D requires the board to establish advisory committees to provide the healthcare industry, consumers, and other stakeholders the real opportunity, to share their perspectives regarding the operations of the marketplace. Subdivision 9 establishes a rulemaking process for the marketplace to follow for the first year after enactment. This is generally a rulemaking process that's borrowed from MDH, the Minnesota Department of Health. Paragraph A authorizes the specified rulemaking, again, for the 1 year following enactment. B requires publication of the proposed rules in the state register. Paragraph C allows interested parties 21 days to comment on those proposed rules. Paragraph D requires that after that 21 days, the marketplace is able to adopt rules. And if the rules adopted are the same, they'll have to republish the fact that they've adopted rules and cite that the rules are the same as initially published. And if they're different, they'll have to say that they're different and explain in the register how they're different and cite the differences again in the original publication. Paragraph E requires the marketplace to seek comments from IPAD, is what it's informally known as. It's the Department of Admin's Information Policy and Analysis Division, before adopting any final rules involving the use or disclosure of any not public data.
Senator, could we back up for a second? Maybe this would be helpful for the members and some of the folks here listening. Subdivision 5, page 9, line 9.16. Now, there's a lot of concern about agents and brokers and others not being participatory or getting their oar in the water, so to speak. And I would think that this is the 916, if I'm reading this right, would allow those subgroups to have more input into the process. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. These are mandatory advisory committees to make sure that the marketplace actively seeks out the advice and perspectives of industry stakeholders, of consumer stakeholders, and other stakeholders broadly, so that this small, nimble board of seven doesn't lose sight of the broader perspective of the marketplace that they're trying to operate within.
I think that was important to reiterate that and let the people know that.
I appreciate the opportunity to stress that piece.
Thank you. Continue on.
Okay, so that was so I finished the first year of rule making. We made it to paragraph E then. Right at the bottom of page 9 there is where we're at for members who are trying to follow. No, I did that one too. Paragraph F, beginning at the top of page 10, requires the marketplace to report back to the legislature, the majority leader and the speaker, and the chairs of the commerce committees. With specific reports of all of the rules promulgated under this expedited rulemaking process, so that we in the legislature have the ability to take a look and make sure that these really are in the interest of the people we're all trying to serve.
Senator, just a small point. I don't know if you discussed this, but when they're line 10.2, the majority leader of the Senate, usually it's the committee on committees of the Senate that they report to instead of the majority leader. I don't know if GovOp has looked at this yet or if they're going to. It's not a huge issue, but that's what's been happening in the history of the Senate. So just take a look at that. I have no strong feelings there, but that's usually how.
I think you're right. Senator Pappas might have thoughts.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pappas.
I think if there were appointments that were being made, that would be done by the Committee on Committees. But this is a report. So unless you wanted to report to the chair of the Rules Committee.
I have no strong feelings.
I think that would be a better thing to do. I think you're right. It would be better to say submit the report to the chair of the Rules Committee, the speaker, and the chairs of the other committees.
Okay. Yeah, I just.
I can make that amendment if you'd
sure,
like.
Sure,
we'll do it on Wednesday.
We'll do it
Let's
Wednesday.
Not start amendments today.
It's not a huge deal. We need some more amendments for Wednesday, right?
There we go.
But that's fine.
I think that would be wise. Make sure that the reports go to the right place to be taken seriously.
Okay.
We really do want to see what's adopted under this incredibly bare bones rulemaking process. Beyond that, subdivision 10, still up at the top of page 10, specifies the rulemaking after the first year. So beginning 1 year after enactment, the board may adopt rules to implement any provisions in this chapter using the expedited rulemaking process in 14.389. That one is the six-month version of rulemaking. The bottom line is if we were to straddle the board with the full-blown rulemaking process, that takes 2 years, and they're just not going to be able to work in this rapidly changing marketplace with two years to promulgate any rule. So the six-month rule seems to be a decent place to wind up after the needed nimbleness of the first year. Section 8, data, also still on page 10. You know, really here the goal is to give the exchange the authority necessary under state law to enter into data sharing agreements and to access data that it will need to carry out required functions of a state-based exchange. These include determining eligibility, facilitating enrollment, providing provider quality data, facilitating premium payments, creating a personal marketplace account for individuals, and authenticating a user's identity. It's important to note that nothing in this bill supersedes any state or federal privacy laws for data practices, and all of Chapter 13 for government data practices is still applicable. That's been a question in several committees and an important question. So within that data paragraph, it states that the definitions in 13.02 apply, states that the data of the marketplace on individuals, employees of employers, and employers using the marketplace are private data on individuals or non-public data for entities that are not individuals. It authorizes the marketplace to share not public data with state, federal, and other entities if the board determines that the exchange is reasonably necessary to carry out the functions of the marketplace that I just kind of laid out. Any data sharing agreements that they enter into must include adequate protections with respect to confidentiality and integrity of the data, and the marketplace is authorized to derive summary data from non-public data under this section. Section 9 is regarding funds, and it states that all funds received shall be deposited into a dedicated fund and that they do not cancel and are available until expended. Section 10 requires the marketplace to submit another report to the legislature by January 15th of 2015, and each January 15th thereafter. This report would include the performance of the marketplace operations, how well they're meeting the marketplace's responsibilities as set out early in the bill, and an accounting of all budget activities undertaken by the marketplace so that the legislature is able to continue proper oversight on behalf of the state of Minnesota. Section 11, we're now on to page 11, states that the board and its advisory committees do not expire and that the board is not subject to review or sunsetting under Chapter 3D. Section 12 is regarding the transfer of authority. It authorizes the commissioner of MMB to exercise all responsibilities until the board has established its bylaws, that 180-day bylaws and rules that they need to do. MMB will be working on it until then. And MMB is exempt from the same statutory provisions as the board, as was described earlier in the bill, and while it's exercising the authorities and responsibilities of the board. Paragraph B states that upon establishment of the required bylaws, essentially MMB will transfer the existing exchange over to the newly created exchange board. Section 13 states that the Commissioner of Commerce, in consultation with the board of the Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association, that's MCHA, our high-risk pool, so Commerce, in consultation with MCHA board, has the authority to develop and implement the phase-out and eventual termination of coverage provided by MCHA, but beginning no sooner than January 1, 2014, when the guaranteed issue is effective so that we make sure that these individuals have a place to go. This is, you know, everyone was hoping to phase MCHA out over 3 to 5 years. There was some federal guidance that was problematic in terms of reinsurance pools, and Minnesota would stand to lose about $60 million in reinsurance because the pools were going to go to a national level, and MCHA would not be eligible to pull in Minnesota's piece of that pool effectively. So we may, in consultation with MCHA, have to speed up the closure of that plan. It would be something that we would take very seriously and be reluctant to do unless it was absolutely necessary, but it's important that they have that ability to go through that conversation. Section 14 of the bill requires another report to the legislature on the building of the appeals process that was spelled out in the appeals section of the bill. And section 15 is really the effective dates. And most of it is effective the day following enactment. And it also states that actions taken by state agencies, basically MMB, in furtherance of the design and development of this marketplace prior to when this passes shall be deemed decisions of the marketplace, so that people have the understanding of where they'd need to go to work with any of these that have already left. So with that, that's a technical nuts and bolts description of everything in the bill, and I'd be happy to roll with questions or listen to testimony with the understanding that, again, I have been and am committed to continuing to work with all stakeholders to try to get to the right place for Minnesotans. I have a number of meetings yet this afternoon with a number of them, and anticipate coming back with some proposed amendments on Wednesday with the help and indulgence of the committee to try to improve this bill yet again through the commerce lens. So with that, Mr. Chair.
Let me just echo, Senator, that the hard work that you've put in on this bill over the last over a year's worth, and your open door policy. And I know you and I have met a number of times and trying to work make this a better bill, so I appreciate your all-inclusive attitude as you've gone from day to day on this bill, so thank you for that. I will take a couple of questions at this time from the author, and then I think we'll get right into testimony, unless, let's get, I see no questions, so thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm sure we have questions.
If you want to do it at this time, that's fine. That's fine.
Really your call, because I know.
That's fine. You could go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lurie, I guess I'll just take Section 6, the governance, and I guess my perspective on that regarding apparently the exclusion of some players seems problematic. I mean, if you look at virtually any other board that you're looking at, whether it's accounting or medical boards or whatever, they use the expertise of the people that influence that. And I guess I want your comment and perspective on that in this first part. Why are you doing that? Why is it that there's an apparent exclusion of some people that really have an important voice in this area?
Senator Lurie.
Chair, Senator Gazelka, you're talking about the conflict of interest, I assume.
Yes.
Provision specifically. And, honestly, this board is constituted to work on behalf of consumers, individuals, and small businesses. And the conflict of interest specified in here is really that trying to get at the level of trust that the public really is going to have for this board and how it operates. And if you allow individuals that have, a concurrent actual financial conflict of interest are getting paid by one of these entities that is doing business with the agency, it really tends to degrade public trust. And so, I mean, if the concern is, are we going to be able to find experts? I mean, I think that is a very legitimate concern, and we've worked very, very hard to try to structure a bill that makes sure that we can attract experts. In Senator Pappas's committee, we added some compensation to the board to try to get people to come forward and offer their time and talents and perspective. So, I mean, we really do want the perspective of a broad group of stakeholders. We're not trying to exclude perspectives. We're trying to exclude people that the public is really going to have a hard time trusting if they are actually receiving a check at the same time that they're expected to cast a vote on this board for measures that affect people in their daily lives. I mean, you got to ask whose benefit is that individual acting on behalf of, and we need to make sure that the public has every assurance that that the board is acting on behalf of consumers in the actions that they take. And then it comes back to the piece that the chair asked me to elaborate again, the mandatory work groups and participation on behalf of stakeholders broadly to make sure that those perspectives aren't lost. You know, people who have a lifelong working knowledge of these would be allowed. I mean, if they're retired, they're able to be on the board. There's expertise in academia that could be brought to fore without that direct financial conflict of interest that really strikes at the core of what individuals and small businesses are looking for in terms of protection. So, I mean, we're really trying to balance and strike the right balance of expertise but still protection of the consumers on the board.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lori, I appreciate your response, but I look at many of the other boards and I just don't see that as a conflict, because you have a number, whether we finish at 7 board members or larger. I see you've given the authority for the governor now to make the appointments, and I'm not nervous about any governor making decisions related to that would be harmful. But to directly intentionally exclude any group from a potential one voice of many, I think is a mistake, and I hope we look at that area as we move forward into Wednesday's discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Lori. Question on work, as Paul was talking about, on this oversight board. Can you tell me, the Governor's Health Insurance Exchange Task Force, what was their recommendation on this board as far as how this board should be set up?
Senator Lori.
There was a governance work group that suggested that the board be small, the way it is structured now, and wanted broad participation. The work group itself, the full-blown task force, came out with a much larger board. As far as the size, I worked on that governance work group as well as the broader task force. As far as the size, I think we're more in line with the recommendations that came from the smaller work group than the broader task force. But that's in the name of nimbleness. With the larger board coming out of the broader task force, the task force did recommend a small minority be allowed to have a conflict of interest. But there's a couple of other pieces that came with it. And again, we're trying to get to the right balance. And, we were straight up with the board that we're going to still try to take those conversations and move the ball forward. The larger board with the small minority allowed to have a conflict also had an explicit consumer majority on the board, which we've lost in this construct, and also a strong recusal policy, which we've also lost in this. So I'm comfortable with where we are and with the conversations that we had with the task force in presenting it in this manner, but it's a good question, and I thank you for it.
On this, Senator Kosofsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You'd already talked about the working with the insurance agent group, so I'm going to leave that one for now. But on 8.3, section 8.3 or line 8.3, where you're talking about active purchasers, it says the board has the power to select carriers and health benefit plans for participation in the Minnesota insurance market. I'm just wondering why you set it up that way, where the board would have the power to eliminate a carrier just because they wanted to. In other words, there's no, if you're qualified, you're in. It's they get to decide. And part of the reason I'm bringing up that and want to talk about that and want you to comment on that is already under the Commerce Department, there's stringent guidelines about what they can provide, what benefits are in there, what the prices are. And so I'm just wondering why you went that route.
Senator Lori.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, another excellent question. I mean, we are teasing out the big ticket items in the bill, fully anticipated. And honestly, the way it's constructed there on line 8.3 with the board having the power to select, that is a conversation I am active with plans and carriers over to, and expect to have some movement ready for that on Wednesday as well. It's, you know, I mean, it's not going to, I'm not going to try to pitch it as it's going to get to the perfect place. But what we have right now, and this goes back to my kind of lead-in comments, that we introduced a fairly bare-bones bill. You read that, the board has the power to select. That's huge. I mean, I say, you know, you got a target, and you don't even know what it is. It's the world. You don't even know where to throw your dart as a carrier to try to make sure that you gain access to the marketplace. And I've owned that, and I've been working with them trying to help narrow that target so that you have a pretty good understanding of what we're trying to accomplish. To put it in context, you know, I think that some ability for smart purchasing and ability to drive the right incentives out of the market is something that's important for this board to have. In fact, you know, there's been polling done on it, and individuals really understand this component and really want some leverage on the part of this board to make sure that the plans offered are in the best interest of consumers. And so we're working on trying to narrow that and make it manageable for plans so that they have some assurance and are willing to step forward and design plans for offerings on the exchange once it's up and running. But making sure that that's there is really pretty important. If you look at the governor's proposed budget, you know, in the Health and Human Services committee area, about $1 billion of the savings that we're deriving in the budget to be able to reinvest in services is from the competitive bidding, the profit caps, and the growth caps placed on HMOs. These are, you know, similar mechanisms of the public entity being able to drive smart purchasing out of the industry, and they yield phenomenal results. So, I mean, I want a marketplace that works for carriers, and you know, I'm not going to try to pretend like we're going to be able to get to a place that everybody loves. We're not going to be, but I am working hard to try to narrow that target down and make it work so that plans understand what we're looking for, and if we do that, I'm confident that they'll be able to step up to the plate. We have a great partnership with today's health plans, and I think that they're going to be able to perform well in this marketplace. And we have some work. They brought me some amendments late Friday. I've spent the weekend thinking about them. They're going to be in my office yet this afternoon, I think. Yes, they are. And we're going to go over that and try to have something ready for Wednesday that improves the bill and makes it, you know, a little better. I'm not, you know, I don't think they're going to be in love with it at the end of the day, but it's going to be more manageable is my hope. And so you have teased out one of the really one of the issues that really has a lot of individuals concerned, and we're working on it.
Follow up, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Laurie, part of it is, you know, I'll wait till Wednesday and see what's coming forward. But I'm concerned because I think you had another bill that is a single-payer bill in the hopper, if I'm not mistaken. And so I'm thinking if we're trying to foster competition, the more people that are eligible to engage, the better. And then secondly, for a provider to want to participate and to gear up, it I'm sure it costs millions of dollars to get ready and to have some predictability that if you meet the measurements and you meet the commerce guidelines that, you know, there's an opportunity. So that's why I'm bringing it up.
Senator Pratt, did you still want to get your hand up a little while ago?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Laurie. Kind of along Senator Gazelka's question, do you envision the plan being, or the marketplace being able to offer its own plan and contacting directly with healthcare providers?
Senator Laurie.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, that's not really in this bill. I mean, what I see is, the health carriers that we know today crafting plans for sale on the market. I mean, I really do want to foster an open, competitive marketplace. And, okay. And I'm serious about that.
I appreciate yeah. that. It was just...
Yep.
Senator Pappas and Senator Housley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a short comment. In the State and Local Government Committee, we did talk extensively about the composition of the board and did support Senator Lurie's proposal to have the board be smaller. Realizing that we need expertise on the board was the reason why we added some compensation. And also there's, I think, a really possible pool of people to serve on this board are former employees yep. of health plans, maybe recently retired, who have a lifetime of expertise in this area. And then also the strengthening and importance of the advisory committees. Yes. I think that's going to be very crucial. And I really do envision this being a working board and it being quite a big workload, which is why we added the compensation, figuring that people who are working or small business owners were going to have to take extensive time off from their work in order to serve on this board.
Senator Housley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lurie, I'm just wondering how much is all of this going to cost? Do you have any numbers of how many people will be in this exchange, how many end users, and is just the 3.5%, is that going to pay for all of it, or if it costs more, where does that money come from?
Senator Lurie.
Mr. Chair, Senator Housley, the initial estimates are that 3.5%, it's going to happen in the first year, again, to build up the reserves. The estimates are that with the enrollment that we're expecting, that'll be able to drop to 3 in the second year and to 2.5 in the third year, and that will cover the costs of the exchange. The estimates put together in Minnesota was really lucky to get early in the game and bring in from MIT some of the best actuaries in Dr. Gruber and Dr. Gorman to give us some really in-depth modeling of how this is going to look. And the current estimates are that by 2016, when this exchange becomes more stable, which is the number that the year that they continually look at, there will be 1.3 million Minnesotans stepping up and using the exchange to select the plan that works for them. And so with that, at that point, it's anticipated to be 2.5. In the bill, it's allowed to be up to 3.5, but the projections with that are that a 2.5% withhold would cover all of the needs, including the navigator function of running the exchange.
Thank you.
Yes.
Senator Goodwin.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Lurie, I just got an email from a constituent that had a couple questions, so I thought maybe others would want to know the answers to these two.
Real time.
He says that, real time. He says that he's concerned that 1 year away from the industry, whether it's the insurance industry, the healthcare industry, in order to serve on the board is not enough, that maybe it should be like 3 years away from the board. So I want to ask you what you think about that. I had concern about, who should be on this board too, but I think you really reassured me with the advisory committee issue that there would be people from the industry serving on the advisory committee, and as long as there are former people that have knowledge in the industry that are on the board that are not any longer in those jobs, I feel pretty confident that that's a good way to go without the conflict of interest. So I guess, first of all, could you address that question on the number of years somebody is away from their job and how you got to 1 year?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, we thought about different ways of constructing conflict of interest. There are pieces that aren't covered in here. Is 1 year the perfect time? I was comfortable with 1 year. Three, people are out swinging their golf clubs and frankly, moving to Florida and Nevada and stuff. It might be hard to get them to come back to Minnesota after a three-year absence from the industry and a 3 years of retirement. I felt okay with 1 year. A couple of things other states have been looking at, if people have been saying that this is really strong conflict of interest. Truthfully, the husband or the wife of a CEO of any of these companies isn't precluded. So it doesn't extend to family members, as some states have done. And truthfully, it doesn't address revolving door issues. They could go back to industry right afterwards. So, I feel we got to a a reasonable conflict of interest policy that would, again, protect the interests of people, but still allow us the ability to really attract and retain true experts in the field. So, I mean, we are trying to get to a reasonable balance. It's important that we have the expertise, but that at the end of the day, the question that I keep coming back to is this board going to function on behalf of the people and small businesses, the consumers that it serves? And that's my litmus test constantly, and I'm comfortable with where we are today.
Is that a good one to follow up?
Thank you. Yes, a follow-up. Also, another question is whether or not in the bill talks about getting bids from the people, the companies that want to sell their product through the exchange. Is there any requirement that you get bids and that you have, that at least three providers, and there any number of providers? And I guess that's his question. My question is, do we have to limit the number of providers in the exchange, or can we put, all insurance providers in there and just be advising the consumers on the costs and the differences in the kind of care and that they'll provide and so forth?
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, unless I'm missing it, I don't think there's anything in the bill right now that speaks to submitting bids. I mean, I think Senator Gazelka pointed it out correctly that right now it's very broad language saying that they have the ability to select, and very broad authority on the part of the board as constructed today, understanding that we're in many in-depth conversations with carriers. And, certainly some states have gone the route of requiring bids for participation. The number of plans offered is one of the industry pieces that we need to make sure is handled well so that individuals aren't overwhelmed with choices, which has happened before. But it's only one of the concerns. A way to address that that's not in the bill today, but that's also being discussed is a meaningful difference requirement so that plans offered on the exchange are different in a meaningful way from other plan offerings on the exchange to try to manage that number. That's one of the things that may come out of our conversations and be brought back before you on Wednesday. We're not through with those discussions yet, but I hope that begins to get at the questions you were raising.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good questions by the panel here. Senator Deems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lurie, could you tell me what's your thoughts on what navigators will be able to do under this bill?
Senator Lurie.
Mr. Chair, Senator Deems, the navigator, as distinct from brokers, understanding that a broker could be a navigator as well if they chose to, but a navigator is more those, and it's actually governed by federal regs, but the navigator is a person that is helping an individual shopping for insurance on the exchange understand the offerings available to them up to the point, but not including actual selection of a plan. So helping individuals understand what the exchange is and how to use the tools that are made available to them to select a plan. If individuals really want help with closing the deal and all the way through, I need help actually choosing among these, say, 5, 7, 9 options. A navigator wouldn't be able to actually help that individual choose a specific plan because we're trying to keep that from them, but they would be able to refer to brokers in that individual's community that could help them. It's really a understanding of the tools available to individuals and ability to navigate those tools and understand what's being made available to the individual, understanding the tax implications, the eligibility, what they have at their disposal, and as far as stepping forward. So, what are your tax subsidies at your current income level? What are your tax liabilities if your income changes throughout the year? If you get determined eligible and you buy with tax subsidies that are Based on your current income, and 3 months later, still within the confines of that year, you get a significant raise, and you continue to receive the advanced premium tax credits. There's a liability for you as the individual at the end of the year. The navigator can help individuals make sure they understand what's there for them and how they can use that to and the rest of the tools available on the exchange to make the best informed choice. But again, it stops shy of actually selecting the product that meets their needs best. Does that help, Senator Daines?
Senator Daines, yeah.
Just a follow-up question. Would a navigator be allowed to make comparisons for an individual of the policies available?
Senator Laurie?
Mr. Chair, Senator Daines, where'd J.R. go? Or Peter, rather.
I guess I got to think he said
that. This is Peter from, he'll say his name for the record, from the Department of Commerce that's very involved in, the distinction between navigators and brokers, which I understand consumed a good deal of the oversight hearing in this committee. So,
okay. Identify yourself.
Mr. Chairman, Peter Brickwoody, Government Affairs Director for the Department of Commerce. Senator Daines. And I would defer to counsel to read it specifically, but Chapter 60K defines certain activities that are licensable in the state of Minnesota. And so the terms, I think, in question that you're looking at here are sell, solicit, and negotiate. And the difference between a navigator and a broker would be that a navigator can, I think the metaphor we've used is a navigator can row a consumer halfway across the river. But once we get to that point where the consumer is ready to make a choice about purchasing an insurance product, the navigator can't take them to the other side where they actually make that sale. And so your question was whether or not a navigator could advise a consumer about differences between products.
If you could make policy comparisons between the different products, can they make that comparison for an individual?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Daines, the definition of negotiate under 60K is the act of conferring directly with or offering advice directly to a purchaser of a particular contract of insurance concerning any of the substantive benefits, terms, or conditions of the contract. And if a person were to engage in that activity, the Department of Commerce would license that individual. And so a navigator is the navigator program by the federal regulations is not licensed by a state insurance department.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So then are you saying we would not allow them to make the comparison?
Sorry, sir.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Daines, yes.
Thank you.
The author said it, but the navigators, the way I understand it, are mandated by the federal legislation. So I guess we know that. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a follow-up real quick. But the exchange will do that, though, right? The exchange will allow, within the exchange, they'll have the ability to compare the plans. Whether or not the navigator does that, the exchange will do it itself. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Jensen, the exchange will facilitate getting the individual to where they need to be to make sure that they're able to help provide stuff. So the exchange, it's not entirely certain. Would they have just navigators on staff? What's that 800 number going to be? If the 800 number that an individual calls or the website that they log on to, if they have those capabilities, if it doesn't give them enough information, there would certainly be referrals to a broker that could actually really get down and compare plans. So it's an open issue whether the exchange would actually hire, and it might be. This would give them the authority to hire a team of five brokers that they could have right within the exchange itself, but that's a policy question that we're struggling with right now, whether that's the right approach or not, or whether a referral to brokers outside for individuals that have seen the tools available to them and want more, want advice on picking a plan. You know, I'm open to that question, and this bill does not answer that question. It allows for that conversation about what the right approach is to continue. Does that help, Senator Jensen?
Jensen, did you have a follow-up?
I do have a follow-up. Thank you for that answer, but what I was getting to is if you're an individual and you go out there yourself, you don't have a navigator or an agent, the exchange itself, by going there, by how it functions, you would be able to compare the plans yourself.
Senator Metzen, Mr. Chair, Senator Jensen, okay. Absolutely.
Okay.
The exchange itself, part of it will be web-based tools that allow for apples-to-apples comparisons on behalf of consumers that are sophisticated enough to really understand what they're looking at. But that is a core function of the exchange itself, is that website that, for many, will be all they need.
Okay, thank you.
To make an informed choice.
Senator Housley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lawyer, what if they aren't sophisticated enough and they don't have access to the Internet? Then where do they get their comparisons?
I think that's the navigator at that point, I would
guess. Mr. Chair, Senator Housley, the exchange is required to have an 800 number and allow for communication via other protocols as well, and will help that individual get find the right place to help them through it. So, I mean, the exchange would have people that could answer the phone and help individuals understand, you know, the best way for them to approach their selection. And it may be, again, referral to brokers that are outside of the exchange that they can actually go and sit with. Maybe a navigator in a current setting would suffice for that individual. It's really geared toward the individual, and we're trying to build a system that has the whole array of support tools to wrap around that individual and make sure that they have the best consumer and user experience possible in their interactions with the exchange. And we're going to be tracking that carefully. It's right in the list of goals, is the ability to help individuals through the exchange get to the right place to make the most informed decision. So we're going to be tracking that carefully. Reports are going to be coming back to the legislature on whether and how much they're succeeding in that, and we can help give them whatever guidance we see fit. This is a board that is of the creation of the legislature, and it is under our jurisdiction constantly, no matter what. We will always have the ability to come back and change how this board is structured at any time. So we will. That is something, Senator Housley, that we will be watching carefully. But it is expressed in the goals.
Senator Housley, did you have a...
Yeah, just to follow up. So, thank you. So as of right now, we don't know the answer to that in concrete, or how much that will cost. Where these people who aren't sophisticated enough, where to go, how they will get their answer, and who those people will be. As of right now, we don't know.
Senator.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Housley, I mean, I think that, it's hard to get the right balance in legislation. Were we to be prescriptive and act like we have the answers for the exact perfect approach to any of these, would be a big mistake for the legislature, to tell you the truth. And so, no, it is not spelled out exactly the right approach in words that go into our statute books. It's for the exchange itself to craft the right approach to make sure that individuals have the best access and the best experience when they present and work through the exchange. And I think that allowing a board that's able to be responsive to consumers' needs is the right approach myself. And so to your specific question, no, I didn't spell it out in this legislation, but that's for a reason, and I think that the legislation itself gives the proper incentives for the board to be operating under, and then there's reports coming back to the legislature for us to determine whether they're meeting those dictates that we gave them.
Thank you.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lurie. The conversation has circled back to the board again, so I received a report from MCHA talking about their governance And the fact, as you said, that they're going to sunset once the exchange is up and running. Yet it seems to be that this was a board constructed back in the mid-70s of industry and consumer advocates working together to come up with the best solution. My question really is, why did we look at creating a separate autonomous board outside of the Department of Commerce as MSHA works with the new rules versus expanding the authority of MSHA that seems for the last 35 years has been somewhat successful?
Senator Lurie.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, the reason we didn't just turn this over to MSHA, I suppose, broadly, is that MSHA is for a specific narrow purpose that was a really important purpose of having a high-risk pool that's funded off of an assessment on plans sold and buys down the premiums of those individuals who aren't able to get coverage out on the marketplace because of pre-existing conditions and the like, and there's caps on how much they pay. And it has been a really well-functioning board, but it's within a limited function that has an established funding mechanism, and it's worked well for that limited purpose. Again, in the governance work group on the task force, and then in the task force broadly, it's been the opinion of most that what we're really looking for here is kind of a quasi-governmental board that has we're established under 15012, which makes it an executive board, but not an agency. And that's the public link that is critical, because this board has to be able to do eligibility determinations, which is a core and central function of the board, and that Medicaid law elsewhere requires that be done by a public body. But then through the exemptions of some of the trappings of the full-blown rulemaking process, some of the Administrative Procedures Act, some of the OET, and other things that make an entity less nimble. That's the private side where we're trying to make sure that this board is able to be insulated from political pressures. So, I mean, it is appointed by the governor, but they serve across governor's terms, with the exception of the commissioner of the Department of Human Services, with staggered boards, so that it has some degree of stability and insulation from our political process. And that's kind of back to where we got where we are on the board makeup.
Okay, I think we're going to a very good discussion tonight. The author's indicated on a number of occasions that his door is still wide open, and he's willing to. We've got some very good questions, I believe, here. And let me have the camera zero in. This is not that complicated. This is an exchange interaction. So anyway, the author will be listening and looking and listening to you folks and all people involved, and we're going to have a better product after the meeting Wednesday, I'm sure. So with that, unless there's an urgent question at this time, I think we'll take testimony. We have an hour left, and I'd like to close on schedule. We're going to close at 2:30, I guess, because we have other committee meetings. So with that, Don Kropp, are you here from Elbert Lee? And we're going to try to, the best we can, 2 or 3 minutes. Just get your points across as quickly as you can. And maybe we might even, if there's some people that are going to kind of talk about the same thing, if 2 or 3 want to come up at the same time, that'd be helpful also. So everybody identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Matt Schaefer. I am with the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, and just wanted to introduce Mr. Kropp. He's been a longtime volunteer with our organization, and to give some context, ACS-CAN has come out in favor of Senate File 1. We thank Senator Lurie for introducing it, bringing it forward, and actually it's been a great discussion over the past few weeks, actually a few years. This has been a long time coming, but in any case, we're particularly supportive of the language dealing with the structure of the governance board, as well as robust conflict of interest statute for many of the same reasons that Senator Lurie has articulated. And with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Kropp.
Mr. Kropp, welcome.
Thank you. And this is my wife, Judy. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Don Krop, and I'm a retired school teacher from Albert Lee. My wife, Judy, and I are here today to thank the Minnesota Legislature for establishing a Minnesota marketplace that will help individuals purchase affordable health care coverage. I'm really here today to talk about our son, Michael. But first, I need to set the stage. Back in 2001, I retired from the Albert Lee Public Schools, where I taught 8th grade science for 33 years. My wife, Judy, had already stopped working as a nurse to care for her aging mother. Being too young for Medicare, we were permitted to continue on the health insurance through the school system, but it was up to us to cover the full cost of family coverage, which was more than $1,200 a month. On a fixed income, we had hoped to find more affordable insurance in the private market, and so began our search for coverage that would cost us less than $14,000 a year. Time and again, we were rejected because Judy has a pre-existing heart disease. No insurer wanted us. We cashed in our retirement fund and spent down our savings to cover the insurance over the years. We are now both on Medicare and are grateful for the program. Over the past 3 years, our concern has turned to our son, Michael, who is a teacher at the Wabasha Kellogg School District and was diagnosed with brain cancer 3 years ago. Fortunately, Michael's employer provides an excellent health plan that covers his many tests, his surgery, treatments, and very expensive chemotherapy. Without the coverage, we don't know where Michael and his family would, how they would survive. With a stage 4 tumor at age 45, we know that eventually Michael will no longer be able to work. No one knows at what point or for how long, his family will have to cope with the disease. Before the Affordable Care Act, Judy and I were worried that they could not afford health insurance if Michael was no longer able to be employed. Our own experience told us that he would have a hard time finding anything affordable. Would this young family have to lose everything to qualify for help? With the Affordable Health Care Act passed, we finally had peace of mind. We knew that with the health insurance exchange, Michael and his family would be able to get the coverage they needed without bankrupting their future. The Minnesota Insurance Marketplace is an important tool for families like mine and many other cancer survivors. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you very much, Mr. Krop. Thank you. Okay, next up, Rick Varco from the SEIU. Welcome to the Minnesota Senate, and particularly to the Minnesota Senate Commerce Committee. We'll get that up there pretty good, I think.
Chairman Metzen, members of the committee, my name is Rick Varco, political director for SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. We represent 15,000 healthcare workers across the state in hospitals, clinics, and nursing homes. As we move forward with this exchange, I think it's important to remember those for whom this bill comes too late. One of those people was the son of SEIU member Pam Bundy, a steward at Abbott Northwestern Hospital. Her son was diagnosed with cancer. And his very difficult chemotherapy forced him to quit his job. Of course, without a job, he lost his insurance. Without insurance, cancer took not just his home and his savings, but it took his peace of mind and his dignity. Towards the end, he was told not to show up for his chemo treatments unless he brought cash. With an exchange, Pam's son would have been able to afford affordable insurance without being screened for a pre-existing condition. Without income, he would have been subsidized so that he could afford health care. SEIU strongly supports Senate File 1, the Atkins-Lori Exchange Bill. In particular, I want to emphasize the importance of the Exchange Board's ability to negotiate with health plans in order to get the lower prices and better coverage. The smart or active purchaser model is necessary to give consumers and small businesses the best options possible. No matter how many different plans or different insurers are available within the exchange, if the exchange board cannot negotiate with the plans, then the options of lower cost, better quality plans will be off the table for all consumers. By negotiating with insurers, the Exchange Board creates new options for consumers, lower cost, better quality options that would otherwise be unavailable. The Exchange Board should have the power to negotiate for lower costs the same way Walmart or any other large-scale purchaser is able to demand lower prices. In a free market, Walmart can buy 10,000 hammers at a lower per unit cost than 1,000 small stores, each buying only 10 hammers, can buy per unit. It's a simple fact of economics that the exchange, as a huge purchaser of insurance, can negotiate for better prices and coverage. We have clear evidence right here at home of our power to negotiate lower health care prices. When Minnesota implemented a competitive bidding process for Medicaid managed care contracts in 2011, it resulted in a savings of $175 million for Minnesota taxpayers. Both cost and quality of coverage were considered in the contract awards, ensuring good care for patients and value for taxpayers. The Medicaid managed care reform demonstrated that any willing health plan systems waste public money to insurance companies, while real competition delivers better care at lower prices. If we're going to force everyone to purchase insurance through the individual mandate, we owe them the option of the lowest possible price.
Jay.
If we're going to spend taxpayer dollars to subsidize insurance in the exchange, we owe it to taxpayers to get them the best possible value. Any business that wanted to offer a selection of plans to its employees would first negotiate with plans for the best possible values. You cannot have a free market if you're not seeking the best value. Free markets presume that every agent will seek out the best deal for itself and the consumers it represents. If the legislature prevents the Exchange Board from acting in the same way any smart business would, you're not preserving the free market. You're rigging the market to protect the interests of health plans and insurance companies.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Mary Jo George from ARP. Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Good afternoon.
Good morning.
Senator Metzen, it is AARP. Not ARP. That's what I was told when I was hired.
I was using the past tense.
Very good.
We can't be too picky. We have votes here. See?
Yeah, no kidding. All right, let me start over. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Mary Jo George, Associate State Director of Advocacy for AARP Minnesota. We appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 1. And we'd especially like to thank Senator Lurie for his leadership in bringing this bill forward. As you may know, AARP represents nearly 700,000 members statewide, 44% of them who are between the ages of 50 and 64. For many of our members, finding access to affordable health care has oftentimes been difficult and challenging. Thus, we are interested in the creation of development of a health and insurance exchange that is consumer-friendly and provides access to quality, affordable health care coverage for consumers and those in the small market. Overall, AARP believes the exchange should ensure that all policy and operational choices should be considered through the lens of the consumer. Thus, we are very supportive of the language in the bill that calls for strong consumer representation and a conflict-free governing board. In addition, we also believe consumers will best be served by the creation of an exchange that is large enough to alter the health insurance market and strong enough to foster active negotiation with the plans. As you heard from SEIU, we think this same approach is used by large employers today to obtain maximum benefits at affordable rates. And it is also the same approach used by the Veterans Administration to negotiate lower drug prices. Unfortunately, today, Medicare does not have that same authority and, as a result, spends an estimated $100 billion more each year on drug prices than the Veterans Administration. So we're urging lawmakers to maintain the authority for the exchange to negotiate on behalf of consumers. Last year, we did conduct a public opinion poll. I do have copies for the committee. What it showed is that Minnesotans are very much in support of a state-designed health insurance exchange that can negotiate on behalf of consumers. In addition, we do support the language in the bill that allows the exchange to offer a number of manageable plans within the exchange. I think you've heard it already today that we think consumers will have a very difficult time comparing plans if there are too many plans. I think the rollout of Medicare Part D is a very good example of this. There were so many plans when that first came out that consumers were overwhelmed and oftentimes found out that plans that they had purchased were no longer there the next year. Lastly, with regard to education and outreach, AARP wants consumers to have clear, objective information about their health plan choices. They also want information from a variety of sources. Thus, we support the role for both navigators and brokers in this bill. However, we do think it is important as we look at the financing arrangements with brokers that we do not create incentives to steer consumers to products that may not be in their best interest. Finally, with regard to navigators, we do see them as playing a key role in reaching out to diverse groups that may have been harder to reach due to language barriers or cultural differences or who may lack familiarity with insurance altogether. I think a very good example that we can look at is the senior linkage line and the role they play in guiding seniors on choosing plans in Medicare Part D, but not advising them to on which ones to purchase. In conclusion, we believe a conflict-free board and strong outreach program combined with the authority to negotiate on behalf of consumers ensures that the exchange will work in the interest of Minnesotans. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. CAP, Arnie Anderson.
Mr. Chair, can I make a quick
yes,
comment?
You may, Senator.
This mostly for the members. There was a Star Tribune article today on exchanges. And the last two testifiers talked about it lowering costs. And yet, in this article, Massachusetts spent $25 million to get theirs up and running. Ours is, I think, $160 million. They charge $30 million a year. We're charging, I think, $60 million. And yet, according to this article, it says they have 15% higher rates than national average. And so I don't want to just assume that because people say this is going to lower the cost, that's not been the case in other places.
Senator Mr. Anderson.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senators, thank you for this opportunity to offer a few very brief comments. I have a handout coming around. Our comments today, by the way, my name is Arnie Anderson with the Minnesota Community Action Partnership. Our comments today are just very briefly to the value of community-based organizations in the Navigator in-person assister system that you're envisioning. This is a very complex undertaking, and we think that it's going to be very important to preserve a lot of flexibility at the implementation stage on the Navigator's in-person assister. So in the letter, we encourage the flexibility in the current language. We also emphasize the importance of the exchange in speaking to the broader public policy issue of the uninsured. We believe that a big part of the success with the in-person navigator will be to leverage existing trust-based relationships, which are very common in community-based organizations throughout the state. On the second page of your handout, and I should add, I believe that some of the members of the committee have also received a similar letter from their local community action agency by now. On the second page of your handout is a hypothetical. The navigator is kind of an elusive concept as it's been discussed in a lot of different ways. So we tried to illustrate using a concrete example of how it might operate in a community-based organization. As AARP noted just before, there's a lot of capacity out there currently in the Medicare supplemental Medicare Part D system that can be leveraged. There's a lot of existing outreach and public education that's available. A lot of capacity to work with those special cultural niches that we want to try to reach. And at the very end of the example from Mojave Community Action, is an example of all the resources that can be wrapped around
the navigator in person, a sister, to help achieve not only the goals of the exchange, but additional broader public policy goals in terms of stabilizing particularly the low-income portion of the market that we're trying to get at. And again, it speaks to some of the existing trusting relationships that are out there that are available. Low-income free tax prep, for example, a very similar type of an activity. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. I think either Senator Lurie or somebody mentioned that earlier that CAP would probably be a very logical navigator in this area. So,
well, thank you. And
it was a good idea. It must have been my idea because I think it was Senator Lurie. But anyway, thank you. And I think that, you'd be, in my opinion, a good stop for many people that you serve already.
Well, thank you. And for what it's worth, the long arm of the Senate would still be involved at the local community action agency. Senator Bruce Anderson serves on the board of the Wright County Community Action Agency. Senator Bach serves on the board of AEOA up in northeast Minnesota. And Senator Gerlach is a new board member at Scott Carver Dakota Community Action Partnership. So,
Thank you very much. Mr. Elwood, Legal Aid. Dominic Spizzetto and others are up next. Tim Wilkins, I don't know if you guys are together or not, but be on deck. Mr. Elwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ron Elwood, Legal Aid, members of the committee. I'd like to address my brief comments to the governance and conflict of interest provisions of the bill. These concepts are intertwined. We tend to immediately get into the weeds on the issue of whether or not industry members should be sitting on the board, whether the conflict of interest standards are too strict. But I'd like to just for a second take a step back and suggest two foundational principles here about this exchange to which I think everybody in this room would subscribe and against which I think the details of this bill should be measured. First, this exchange has been conceived and will necessarily operate in the public interest. And as such, it carries the burden of the public trust. The integrity of its decisions, regardless of whether any one party agrees or disagrees, must be beyond reproach. Second, in order to earn and maintain that public trust, the board must be independent and objective. The professional judgment of any one of the members of the board in all its decisions must never run the risk of being compromised. So, little weeds now. Black's Law Dictionary defines conflict of interest as, and I quote, a real or seemingly incompatibility between one's private interest and one's public duties. And I submit that the wall that this exchange builds against being compromised by self-interest must be impenetrable. Ensuring against even the appearance or perception of impropriety and conflict is as important as ensuring against the actual conflict. And to the issue that we need experience and expertise on the board, and the bill in its current form prevents that, I'd like to point out that two states, California and Maryland, with named boards, prove that those concerns do not necessarily have to materialize. California's board contains an executive director of a nonprofit, nonpartisan public policy institute, a foundation president, a director of human resources at a prominent bank. Maryland's board contains the chair of the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, a professor and the University of Maryland School of Public Policy, a business person unaffiliated with the healthcare industry whatsoever, the executive director of the American Public Health Association, and an executive of a health research nonprofit who also happens to be the head of an initiative supported by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Experience on the board is necessary. Self-interest and self-dealing on the board are fatal. I've also heard often that the MSHA board, which is contains many industry members, should serve as a model for the exchange board. I served on a similar board, the Minnesota Joint Underwriters Association, and was appointed to terms by both Governor Ventura and Governor Pawlenty to serve on that board. The difference between the exchange and the MSHA board actually underscores why the MSHA model should not serve as the model for this exchange. MSHA and the MJUA are insurers of last resort. When consumers cannot be placed in the traditional market, then that's where MSHA and MJUA are used. There are generally no competing products for companies in that system. In contrast, the exchange is the insurer of first resort, where there is much competition for business. And therefore, a strong argument could be made for strengthening the conflict of interest provisions, prohibiting, as some have said before, revolving door, extending conflicts to family members, ensuring expertise and disinterested board membership that solidifies the integrity of the board and bolsters the public trust. So finally, I know you need to move on. I just want to suggest to you that there are significant due process protections in this bill, built in by Senator Loring and the amendments made in the last committee. There now is rulemaking with all due process protections inherent in Chapter 14. Healthcare carriers who believe they are aggrieved by a decision by the board are entitled to a contested case proceeding, and that entitles them to full judicial appeal as well. So in some members, the success of this exchange will rest on the degree to which the public trust is held, and the public trust will be ensured and maintained by ensuring the most independent, disinterested board membership and the strongest possible conflict of interest standards. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we'd like to hear from Dominic. Are you there? Yes, there he comes. Spicetto. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name's Dominic Spicetto. I'm here representing four different agents' associations under the rubric of the Agents Coalition for Healthcare Reform. With me is Greg Seiler, who is an insurance agent who will have an opportunity to address you in just a few minutes. I thank you for the opportunity to be here. First of all, I'd like to express somewhat appreciation to Senator Lurie and the commissioners of Management and Budget and Commerce, who have obviously recognized the important role of agents and brokers in the state by including us as members of the health insurance exchange marketing efforts. There was a great deal of concern and anguish among the agent community that we would actually be barred from participating or be forced to be navigators working under the rubric of the exchange on some sort of a salary basis. And it was a very real concern, and I'm pleased to say that it doesn't seem to be a concern any longer, and we're pleased to be working with those individuals. I think the inclusion of agents and brokers is very, very important if you want the exchange to succeed. And I think the role that they provide will be very prevalent, and everyone will have an opportunity to see it once the exchange is up and running. Still, there are many agents that are not happy with the Affordable Care Act, and you're going to hear from them. But I'm here to tell you today that the organizations that we represent have accepted the fact that the Affordable Care Act is law, and we've accepted the fact that Minnesota has chosen to develop its own health insurance exchange, and we're very supportive of that. And we're committed to working with the legislature, the auditors, commissioners, and the exchange itself to make this thing a success. However, we do have some requests that we would like to make. Specifically, we want to make sure that there is the maintenance of a significant role for insurance producers writing both within the health insurance exchange and outside the health insurance exchange in the private market. We'd like to see adequate training for producers involved with the exchange that fits within the current system that we have for education and training under our Department of Commerce, and we'd like to see equitable compensation for their services. And lastly, we would love to see a recognition of the effect that the insurance exchange will have on the market outside of the exchange because of some of the rules of the federal rules that have come down related to products both inside and outside the exchange. Keep in mind, and you've heard this from the exchange staff, that we're talking about at best 20% of Minnesotans becoming involved in the exchange. That leaves 80% of our population still out there in what we call our private market or through various public programs. And we think that that is important to take into effect when you go forth with this particular program. There is a provision in the bill related to agent compensation. I'm not going to discuss that today. We've expressed concerns about that previously, and we're working with the author on some language that looks like it will go a long way to addressing our concerns, and we'll hopefully can reach some consensus on that by Wednesday. But I do want to say, to paraphrase Vice President Biden, this is a big honking deal. And this is something that we have to proceed with caution. Again, keep in mind, we're talking about setting up a health insurance exchange to provide products to a certain segment of our population, not the entire population. This is not going to be the monopolistic exchange that runs the health insurance marketplace in Minnesota. We know that. I mean, others have expressed fear about that, but we're pretty sure the way it's drafted that that's not the case. We also want to keep in mind that we're basically melding two different markets together. We have our public program system and our private system, and they are today two distinct operations with differing benefits, differing compensations for providers, and a completely different system of enrolling people in those different products. We're melding them together. We have to go slowly to make sure we do both correctly and create a bridge between the two. And in some days, I would envision brokers and navigators working together, trading clients back and forth depending on their incomes and the programs that they fit into. So it would be a very cooperative effort. And lastly, I'd like to say that we're somewhat worried that we take a very heavy or prescriptive regulatory approach with this exchange or marketplace. It should be a vehicle to assure that we have universal coverage in Minnesota. We don't want it to see it as an entity that engages in healthcare reform in terms of quality controls or accountable care organizations or medical homes or some of the things that we've been talking about in Minnesota since 2009 and the health department and others have been working on. It appears at times that this may be a vehicle to pursue that, and we just don't think that's the right body to do it. And it would, frankly, give it too much power and authority over the entire marketplace. So our caution is to go slow, proceed. Remember, we all want to make this work, and to do so, I think we have plenty of time over the years to fine-tune it if it needs to be fine-tuned, but to basically just meet the tenets of the federal law, get it up and running, and see how we do. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I would agree it is a big honking deal. Thank you. Okay.
Okay. Mr. Chair, committee members, Senator Lurie, good afternoon. My name is Greg Seiler, and I own an independent insurance agency with six employees in Lake Elmo called Seiler Benefit Services. And we assist over 200 employers and over 1,000 individuals find their health insurance each year. I'm here representing today the Agents Coalition for Healthcare Reform, which is comprised of four professional insurance agents, associations. In Minnesota, Minnesota Health Underwriters, MAHU, National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, the Professional Insurance Agents, and Minnesota Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers. Collectively, we're over 54,000 agents in Minnesota, with our employees included. As such, we work very closely with the group in individual markets and helping them find their coverage on a daily basis. Have supported and continue to support an insurance exchange that supports the unique Minnesota healthcare system and insurance marketplace. Our members have spent countless hours in Governor Dayton's health insurance task force and working groups that are part of those task force. I'd like to start off by thanking Senator Lurie for working with us to eliminate the portion of the bill that addresses the agent compensation. While we understand the original intent of the language better now, we think it would not have worked well, and we are grateful for his willingness in compromising. To remove it. We have a few remaining concerns about the bill as introduced, as we will continue to work with Senator Lurie to address them. We greatly appreciate his willingness to hear our concerns. We are concerned that the exchange may include types of products besides those required by the ACA. Specifically, that adult dental products will be included by the definition. We also would like to see a prohibition of products other than health insurance and pediatric dental be included in the bill so that it is clear that the legislature does not intend for the exchange to invade other parts of the marketplace. We're also very concerned about the makeup of the board and the fact that it excludes those with expertise and experience in the health insurance market, including agents and insurance carriers and their employees. There seems to be a unique view of conflict of interest that suggests only those with practical experience with the needs of consumers have a conflict, while consumers and activists who bring their own agendas have the conflict. The reality is everyone who serves on the board can and probably will have a conflict at some point. Even consumers can have a conflict when a vote comes up on an inclusion of a benefit for feature that might impact their personal situation or that of someone they are close to. The proper way to handle this issue is to adopt a policy that anyone with a conflict of issue must recuse themselves from the vote on that issue. The exchange is set up to serve all Minnesotans, and we should not exclude anyone from board eligibility. We are concerned that the funding mechanism takes 3.5% from premiums on policies sold within the exchange, will add to the affordability problems of these policies sold both inside and outside of the exchange, and add to the cost of premiums that will already be increasing due to changes required elsewhere in the ACA. This 3.5% taken from the premiums within the exchange will also be felt outside of the market due to the ACA's requirements that the products sold inside and outside of the exchange be the same premium. This added expense will be felt solely by the fully insured market, which is now less than 25% of the market. We think the fee should either be borne by those benefiting from policies sold inside the market or put on a much broader base that does not solely burden the small businesses. Finally, our most serious concern remains is the active purchaser model. As representatives of both individual and group consumers, we do not believe the market will welcome the exchange board with a four-person majority deciding what products are best for them. Please understand that once the market inside the exchange is limited, the exchange will move to limit the choices for constituents in the market outside of the exchange. Remember, President Obama, in passing the ACA, spoke often about choice and competition. We agree that with that statement and feel the exchange need to include both choice and competition. We encourage you to amend the bill to allow for an open market. Only in an open market that accepts any willing health plan will consumers be able to find affordable health plans that meet their diverse needs. We look forward to continuing to work with Senator Lori and the difficult job he has to craft a compromise bill. Thank you for your time and the opportunity to be heard.
Thank you. We'd like to hear from Cheryl Freeman. Is she here? Here she comes.
Hi, Cheryl Flatman. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you all for allowing me to talk. It's fitting I follow my contemporaries. I am an independent insurance agent. I own an independent insurance agency, which is also a small business, and have been in sales for over 30 years. Sell all sorts of products, so I've been selling health insurance for quite some time. Rates go up, seem to go up every year. Group rates seem to go up 15%, and every year group rate go up 15%, the insurance companies say they've had a 15% profit. I know for a fact that most insurance agencies do not have any type of plan for any of their employees. The larger agencies with over 50 people are able to have a program because they're able to negotiate the pricing. There is no true small group rate negotiations. I've been able to work closely with the insurance companies themselves in trying to figure out how to make this work. Unfortunately, the only answer that anyone has ever given is higher and higher deductibles. That isn't feasible. People don't have that kind of money sitting around to increase deductibles and have to wait to get health care provided to them. So I feel the exchange is going to be very helpful in that area as long as we work with the insurance companies that we have already here in Minnesota that have done a good job in making sure that there's a good product for the benefit received. It'd be very logical to go with a larger hospital deductible as opposed to having these huge deductibles on the front end. I'm suggesting in the exchange when they're working with the insurance companies themselves to come through with something that would be a little bit more affordable for all and be able to lower the deductibles so people would be able to pay their bills. Time and time again, I've had so many of my clientele who have not been able to buy health insurance, and all I can say is knock on wood for MCHA, it has helped a lot of them. I don't feel a lot of the agents used it as much because they were only paid $50. So I understand where we're coming from when the association and all the individual agent producers and the agents coalition all wish to make sure that the producers are paid. It would be helpful because working together with the navigators will make it right for the public. I work for the people, not for the insurance companies. And I stress to you, please, we're in support of this bill, but as a small business owner, I have to let my group health go. Cannot afford it anymore, and I'm in the industry. And I think that's something to look at when it's the industry itself has not ever taken care of its own and hasn't put together a group product, and that makes me very curious. So I agree with you having not having all the expertise in one area, but you do need the expertise of insurance people who have been selling the product and working with the public every single day. I just want to say one more thing. I do feel bad about MCHA because I think it has worked out real well. And be careful, because the insurance companies not necessarily will tell you, oh, yeah, we're going to cover everybody, because they won't. And time again, people have nowhere to go to get a product that they can afford. So that's all I have to say.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Audrey Britton? Small Business Minnesota Government Relations.
Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time today and for hearing this testimony. My name is Audrey Britton, and I am the Public Affairs Chair of Small Business Minnesota and principal of a small business called Britton Communications. I am here today to provide testimony on behalf of Small Business Minnesota. Small Business Minnesota is a nonprofit, nonpartisan association. All of our members are small business owners with 100 or less employees. Small business is Minnesota's largest employer. Even though Minnesota is fortunate to have more Fortune 500s per capita than any other state, Minnesota small businesses employ more people than all the state's Fortune 500s put together. According to the latest available U.S. Census data, Minnesota is host to approximately 500,000 businesses, of which 99% of them are small businesses with 100 or less employees. Of those, the majority of them actually have fewer than 20 employees. The vast majority of small business owners take home less than $100,000 a year in salary, and very few, if any, can afford a lobbyist, and most are very busy running their business and do not have time to spend at the Capitol. While there have been very effective voices for big business in Minnesota, there has yet to be an effective voice for small business. Small Business Minnesota has been organizing over the past year to become this voice. As mentioned earlier, our members are only small business owners. So Small Business Minnesota conducted a member survey last fall. Our survey found that affordable health care was the number one priority among our members. Small Business Minnesota strongly supports the provisions in Senate File 1 that allows the state to negotiate group rates or be an active purchaser. Because the majority of small businesses employ fewer than 20 people, access to group rates is extremely limited, and therefore the cost prohibitively high for small business owners and their employees. There exists a real need for access to negotiated, true group-rated health insurance for small businesses. Even though we are the largest job creators, we do not have access to a large collective pool of employees that drives down health insurance costs. As one small business member told me, insurance companies claim they give a group rate, but they are really just rating us as individuals, and underwriting allows them to raise the small group rate. That comes from an insurance agent, by the way. Negotiating with insurers to lower prices and better quality coverage is commonplace in the insurance market. Large employers negotiate with insurers on behalf of their employees. State agencies negotiate with insurance over public health care coverage. Small business employers need the exchange to negotiate for better prices and benefits for them and their employees. And I cannot stress to you enough, this is the majority of the employees in Minnesota that do not have negotiated rates. This is about leveling the playing field. We can't continue paying more than large businesses for the same coverage. Our members have told us that they have troubles attracting and retaining top talent because small business owners cannot compete with health care packages provided by the large packages negotiated by big businesses. An owner of a small engineering company told me he lost an employee because she was planning to start a family and needed to work where there was better maternity coverage. An owner of a graphic design company said they can no longer offer health benefits and understands the disadvantage this creates as they are in the process of hiring more employees. Small Business Minnesota also strongly supports the provision in the bill that calls for representation of small businesses on the Health Exchange Oversight Board, and we agree with the inherent conflict of interest statements in the bill. We want to do what we can to ensure this position is filled by someone who truly represents small businesses without an affiliation to organizations that have a history of lobbying for or with insurance providers and large corporations. Small businesses have plenty of experience with insurance markets overseen by insurance companies. We need a strong board representative who can negotiate on our behalf. So in summary, small business is Minnesota's largest employer by far. Yet true group rates and negotiating power have not been available to us. Healthcare costs are often or are already prohibitive for both small business owners and their employees. Being unable to offer health care benefits that compete with what big businesses offer puts small businesses at a severe disadvantage when trying to attract and retain top talent. Therefore, we support Minnesota being an active purchaser, and we want to ensure the representation of small business on the overseeing board is maintained and filled with the true voice of small businesses. Voting against this bill is indeed voting against small businesses in Minnesota.
Thank you. We do have a question, Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, how many members are part of Small Business Minnesota?
We've been organizing over the past year, putting our board in place. We're closing in on 100 members and growing every day. This gets in the newspaper, the more people are contacting us, asking us for their help.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, 100 members out of 500,000 businesses does not represent business.
Okay, can I address that?
Certainly.
So I don't think even the chambers would say they speak for all big businesses. As we know, several of the local chambers wrote letters saying you indeed do not represent our interest. I'm not sitting here today saying that we represent all small businesses. I'm saying I'm carrying forward the voice of many small businesses, and I would be at a loss to think that there is a small business owner out there out of all the stories I've heard that is saying, yeah, health insurance is affordable and it doesn't impede me attracting and retaining talent.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Todd Mickelson?
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much, committee members, Madam Chairperson. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. I'm Todd Mickelson, and I own a small business that I built around a patented invention of mine that and other products I've developed works in architectural testing, and we assemble all of these products and also conduct training in our facility in the Old Tonka Toys building on Lake Minnetonka. And we sell to countries all around the world. You may have seen an article in this Sunday's Star Tribune business section in which I was featured. I talked about the troubles we, as a small business, have had securing small loans and credit, and that we feel as though we've been penalized just for being a small business. We also feel like we're in the penalty box when it comes to the subject of health care. Being small business owners, we must secure our own health care coverage. So my wife and business partner, Heidi, spends a fair amount of time managing this. She, my 9-year-old daughter, Eve, and I are pretty healthy. We take good care of ourselves, very seldom have to see the doctor. I went to urgent care last year because I developed a nasty rash on my leg I thought for sure would kill me by the end of the weekend, but it turned out to be poison ivy. Now, I, of course, had to pay for this visit out of my own pocket. Dental coverage is out of the question for us. It's prohibitively expensive. So, of course, regular trips to the dentist are also paid for out of our pocket. If our daughter were to break her arm, it would cause us to go in debt to pay the high deductible, even though we pay hundreds each month in health insurance costs. it feels to us as though we have no health insurance at all. So my wife, Heidi, continues to constantly be on the lookout for a better deal for our insurance. Spending a fair amount of time at it, too. That seems like another penalty on small business owners. Now we're faced with the possibility of growing our small business, which you think would be a good thing, and it is. This is, in fact, in our plans for the next few years. But like other small business owners, most small business owners, we're waiting to see if also providing employees with health insurance is even going to be possible. We're very excited for the changes being made. Heidi's looking forward to an exchange where she can easily compare health care plans, and we very much hope that the Minnesota Health Care Exchange bills pass with provisions that allow the state to negotiate group rates. This would greatly encourage us to more vigorously pursue our plans to grow our business. We also strongly believe there should be a representative for small business on the oversight board and would be gravely disappointed if the conflict of interest provisions did not survive. So thank you very much again for letting me speak today.
Thank you for being part of the conversation. We do have Ben Triagas. If you have something additional.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Chair. My name is Ben Kiriagis, and I live and work in Plymouth, Minnesota. Together with my wife, we own and operate for 24 years a company that sells commercial electronic equipment worldwide. In addition to ourselves, we have two full-time employees. We presently do not offer health insurance benefit to our employees. My wife and I have a high deductible plan of about $5,000 deductible, and our monthly premium is $1,460, just for the two of us. This includes the contribution to our health savings account. Depending on the year, this cost represents approximately 15 to 20% of our annual taxable income. We need the health exchange for two reasons. One, to reduce our health insurance costs for ourselves, and two, to offer health insurance to our employees. About 75% of all candidates we have interviewed in the past required health insurance. And since we could not afford to offer that, we had to find employees that were able to work without health insurance benefits. This puts us in a disadvantage against large companies that can afford health insurance. We have three great hopes for the health care exchange. Number one, we hope that the exchange will do the research and select a few plans that will meet the needs of most small businesses like ours. We do not want to search among hundreds or thousands of choices. We need a few good and cost-effective choices. We do not have the time or expertise to do the analysis paralysis. We hope the exchange will do that. Number two, we hope that for the first time ever, we will have someone to represent us in dealing with insurance companies. You cannot negotiate when your group is four people. All small businesses together are the largest group possible. I hope we will get some of that buying power. Big business already have many advantages, and they also get lower cost health insurance. The time is long overdue that small businesses had lower cost health insurance. It is a matter of fairness, and in many cases, it's a matter of survival. And we hope, number three, and the last one, we hope that this exchange will not be controlled by insurance companies or big business or organizations that had fought tooth and nail against the establishment of the health exchanges. We need real small business people on the board of the exchange to make sure that they perform the role that they were designed to do, mainly to help individuals and small businesses buy affordable health insurance. If insurance companies are controlling the exchange, it will be like the fox guarding the chicken coop. And we had enough of that. I kindly request that you do not allow this to happen again. Thank you very much.
We do have one question, Senator Dobbs.
Madam Chair, and I'm going to refer to you as sir because I'll butcher your name if I don't.
Yeah, my name is Ben. My last name is Kiriagis. That's Kyriagis.
Mr. Kiriagis.
And it's Greek.
Question.
Yes.
You're talking about having employees that you're not able to provide health insurance for the cost.
Correct.
Can you give me some idea what what the cost would have to be to make it affordable for you to provide health insurance. What kind of a range do you feel it would take for you to be able to do that per family?
I would say what the big companies pay. And my understanding is that range is around $300 to $400. We're not asking for special treatment. We're asking for small businesses to pay what big businesses have been paying forever.
So, Madam Chair, follow-up. So it's your opinion that you should be able to buy a policy for in that $300 to $400
for
range?
The same price that the average large company pays today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ron Seeloff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ron Seeloff. I'm a practicing lawyer with my primary office in Eagan, Minnesota. And much of my practice relates to the taxation and family law issues and the intersection of these two practices. I also happened to serve in the state Senate for 10 years, and
back in 1937.
Daily emphasize with all of you.
What year was that? In the late 30s?
The 1830s?
No, it was later than that, 1930s.
I retired in 1986, Senator.
I know. I had the chance to serve with Senator Seeloff, and he's considered a very good friend of mine. That doesn't mean we're always going to agree with you today, but go ahead, Mr. Seeloff.
I'm a Republican. Senator Metzen is a Democrat, and we got along just fine.
Just fine. We sure did. We need more of that.
We do. Okay. We do. The purpose of my testimony today is to communicate to you from the perspective of working and middle-class people how this bill is going to affect them in practice. Now, I'm not here speaking on behalf of any stakeholders, but I'm just trying to communicate to you for the middle-class people for whom the ACA is going to create benefits, burdens, and some many surprises. Now, I presented to the committee, and I would like you to review, because it will actually decrease the length of my testimony, some materials about how the ACA will work in practice and certain recommendations I've made to you. Now, I'm going to skip over much of my testimony because it's getting late, but what I would first like to tell you is my recommendations. I agree that we should pass an exchange bill, Senator Lori's bill or one like that, but I believe that the Minnesota Senate and the Minnesota House should pass a joint resolution memorializing to our congressional delegation and to the president that the ACA should be delayed for 1 year. And I say that because although the task force and the board says that they think they're going to be ready for the ADA, the people of Minnesota are not ready for the ACA. They simply aren't. Most of them have no idea of what it means in principle, and almost none of them have an idea of how it's going to affect them in practice. The second thing I wanted to talk to you about was how this is going to affect children who live in single-parent families. Now, about 30% of all children live in single-parent families, and 50% of children live in single-parent families at some time during their life. The ACA and what this committee does has a dramatic effect on that. And I am recommending to this committee that either on the board or as an advisory committee that parents of single children families participate in how this is going to work. The reason for that is because the ACA allocates the responsibility to carry the insurance, the mandate, the penalties for failure to do so, and the subsidies, the tax credit, based on who gets the tax exemption for the children. And under existing Minnesota law, the allocation of the responsibility to carry insurance in many cases is entirely inconsistent with the principle of the ACA, which is taking public subsidies from a welfare approach where the county is always trying to recollect tax dollars into an entitlement approach. and that unless something is done, there is going to be a waste to deserving parents of thousands and thousands of dollars of the tax credits. Now, the last thing I want to talk to you about is the issue about how this is going to affect middle-class people. And in my materials on page 6, I've done some calculations. And the calculations I do show that in some cases an incremental increase in income will result in less money after tax than if you didn't work. Now, on page 6, you'll see an example I gave where I have a married couple with two children with a health insurance cost of $15,000, not unreasonable. That family, the assumption here is that that family's household income increased from $80,000 to $93,000, certainly something within the realm of possibility. Well, as a consequence of that, that will put them above the subsidy level, and there will be a $7,400 loss in the subsidy to that family, which is a 57% marginal tax. When you add on the 22.2% state and federal rate, 50% federal, 7.2% state, the FICA tax and the Medicare tax, plus the other income-adjusted items, after that family has earned an additional $13,000, they've gone out and worked for it and got another job, their net take-home pay is going to be less than they had if they didn't work. Make that extra money. So I submit to you is this what we're trying to tell people to do? Reduce your income. And I'll just say that if the ACA is seen as part of a ladder to success, what has it in fact done? It's kicked out the middle rungs of the ladder. And unless you're Superman and you can jump up from an income of $30,000 to $225,000, what's going to happen is that you are going to be a big loser. And one of the reasons I'm telling you to pass a resolution to delay the implementation of this act is because we are not going to know the effect of this act until after the end of August when these insurance premiums come in. And it's going to be too late. And because you are not going to be in session and you are going to have people, in my opinion, with pitchforks and shovels racing at the Capitol telling you that this is just awful. I want to just one more example, and then I'll keep my peace. Here's an example of a 58-year-old single person who is either voluntarily or involuntarily unemployed and has a regular base income of $36,000. Look at page 7 of my materials. This person has worked his whole life to invest in an IRA, 401k, or deferred compensation plan. And his plan was that until he gets to be Social Security age, he's going to take $12,000 a year out of his IRA until he gets to be 62 or 67. Now, the consequence of that, of a person doing that, is that he is going to lose the premium subsidy of $6,265 a year. Now, that's based on a medium premium, which is projected. Plus, he's going to pay a tax of 22.2%. Plus, he's going to pay a 10% penalty. So the effect of this person making a completely rational plan of how of going forward in life is that he's going to take he's going to lose like 89% of his IRA distribution. So here's what's going to happen. He's going to say, I'll tell you what, I'll take $24,000 out 1 year and I'll take nothing out the next year. That way I get my full subsidy in the second year, nothing in the first year. Or they're going to say, I'm not going to buy any insurance. I'll pay the $540 penalty in the 1 year, and then I'll get all the subsidy in the next year. Here's the point I want to make to you, is that there are people in the real world making decisions today, even as we speak, about how they're going to handle the retirement income. They have no idea what this bill is going to do to them. And when 2014 comes around and you see this retiree finding out that he's paying 89% of his income back to the government, he is going to be pretty mad. So here's what I'm asking the committee to do, is that I think that you ought to pass that resolution and ask for a delay You know these things now. The people don't know them. At least you'll be able to tell your constituents that there are some problems here and we tried. Really, you have no control over it. This is not your problem. This is in the ACA. So what I would just like the committee to do is review my materials. I have a very detailed analysis of how this affects family, a single-parent family, on my website at CLOF, at CLOFlaw.com. On that is the presentation I made to the Family Law Institute in 2011, the CLE program, which lays it all out. There are so many problems. I'm trying to protect you. You should try to protect your people. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. CLOF. We're going to have one two-minute presentation from Mr. Neumeister, and then we're going to go. We're going to come in Wednesday. I'll explain that later, but keep it very brief.
Mr.
We're
Chairman,
doing you a favor here because you cannot show up, I believe,
Mr.
Wednesday.
Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. If you go directly to the bill, go on page 3, lines 3.7. It says application of other law. You talk about the public trust. The important tool for a public trust is that make it clear that this board is under the Data Practices Act. So the suggestion of language that I give to you is as follows. The Minnesota Insurance Marketplace is subject to the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. Make it clear. It's not ambiguous. It's very clear that all data comes under the Data Practices Act. On the other item, this will go back to that same page on lines 314, on lines 316, and 318 through 320. Issues of open meeting law. Basically, the language you have in here swallows Chapter 13D. So, I mean, I've already shared with briefly in a real quick comment with Senator Lowry, just a little bit of a banter I had with Mr. Reich, and Mr. Lowry heard part of that. It needs to be clear that this is open to the under the open meeting law. And it gives the board too much discretion to close meetings. And one of the things where the public hears things is in an open meeting. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for the few moments of your time. I just wanted to get that on the record so at least I can start working with you all.
Very good. Thank you. We're going to meet. Well, we're meeting Wednesday at noon. And let's be here on time. We're going to do about 35 to 45 minutes on additional testifiers. And then spend almost 2 hours on amendments to the bill. So with that, Senator Lowry has been very open, and visit with him ahead of time would probably be a good idea. And if there's a consensus, fine. If not, we'll battle it out here Wednesday. But my way of doing business is try to work things out ahead of time, if possible. It's not always possible, but let's work together. So with that, the meeting's adjourned, and thanks, everybody, for your patience. Meeting's adjourned.